Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Short-term rentals, mason jars, and kids. Have them or don't. That's what we got today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 7th of December. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, one might reasonably ask, as we're seeing virus counts rise and whatever the economic recovery has been so far, we're seeing it falter a bit. One might reasonably ask, are you sure you want to take your company public now? All year and increasingly here in the waning weeks, the answer has been yes. The meal delivery service DoorDash starts trading publicly on Wednesday. Airbnb follows on Thursday. And the short-term rental company is feeling pretty confident, looking for a total valuation of something like $42 billion, which would be some kind of comeback, I'll tell you what, from this spring when the pandemic upended Airbnb's whole business model. Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going today.
Airbnb was planning an IPO back in March, but we all know what happened that month. As global travel ground to a halt, bookings fell by 80%, and the company had to refund $1 billion. Here's CEO Brian Chesky on Bloomberg this summer.
I felt like a captain of a ship and a torpedo just hit the side of the ship.
The company laid off a quarter of its staff, nearly 2,000 people, cut executive salaries and marketing, and focused on the core short-term rental business. And by September, Airbnb was profitable again. Tariq Dogru teaches hospitality management at Florida State University. He says as domestic travel picked up, Airbnb offered something hotels didn't.
It's all yours. You are not gonna, if you don't want to, encounter with the host. And some people really shifted, I think, to Airbnb.
Not everywhere. Jamie Lane tracks the short-term rental industry at AirDNA. He says in big cities like New York and San Francisco, demand is still down 40 to 60% from a year ago.
But where demand is up, and it's up significantly, is in small towns and destination markets throughout the country.
Places in the mountains or at the beach that are easy to drive to from metro areas. And with more people able to work or go to school remotely, they're staying longer, too. Another reason to go public now? Investors are chasing returns in a hot stock market, says Kathleen Smith with Renaissance Capital.
It may be one of the worst years when it comes to the pandemic, but it's been one of the best years for IPOs.
So far, companies have raised more than $140 billion, with several more big IPOs to go. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A very quick update here on the status of the coronavirus relief bill in Congress. It's still stuck. That's the whole update. Oh, and the government officially runs out of money on Friday. There is talk of a stopgap spending bill to get us another week. That sound you hear is indeed a can being kicked down the road. All right, moving on. $300 million in exchange for a life's work is the music industry news of the day. As you've heard, Bob Dylan has sold all of his rights to his catalog to Universal Music. As Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, it is kind of a move for the ages.
People have watched the world change through Bob Dylan's music.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times they are a-changing.
And Dylan watched the music business change. When he started out in the 60s, the money was in album sales, then concert tours. Now?
That equation has sort of gone upside down in recent years.
Larry Miller, a music business professor at NYU, says these days it's all about licensing for commercials, movies, and covers. Lots of singers cover Dylan. And the pandemic is boosting the value of digital everything, including streaming.
for artists who have been creating great work with a fantastic earnings history for many decades, now is an excellent time to sell.
That's not the only kind of timing that matters here, says Marcus Thomas, who chairs the music industry department at the University of Hartford.
The reason you may see this with a legacy artist, I hate to be morbid, but obviously, you know, they're legacy artists.
Okay, since he won't say it, I will. Dylan is 79 years old, so maybe now's a good time to figure out how his music will live after he dies. The slog of administrative work that comes with licensing isn't a great gift to leave family members.
Register copyrights, pursue licenses, track down the royalties.
And on and on. So instead of all that, maybe Dylan wants to leave his heirs with hundreds of millions in cash. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Quick thought here about all these companies going public this year to round out the top of the show and to pick up on the end of Amy's story. Interest rates are basically zero right now. They're going to be there for a while. You want a return on your investment? You got to go to stocks. So despite a shaky economy, the markets are where the money is. Today, though, on Wall Street, not really so much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. American consumers, while sometimes fickle and easily distracted by the next shiny object, are dependable in at least one key area. We do love us a good discount. So you'd think, with the economy stalling and Congress dithering, retailers would be offering big sales to get people in a buying mood before the holidays. Oh, but not so. Companies from Gap to American Eagle to Dick's Sporting Goods and L Brands all say they are offering smaller discounts than they used to. As Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports, there is a strategy at play here.
Let's go back for a moment to the last recession, which started in late 2007. The economy was in the tank, millions of people had lost their jobs and their homes, and retailers were desperate. So they started offering steep discounts, and that got people to shop. But that strategy doesn't really make sense this time. Tiffany Hogan is an analyst at Kantar.
I think the real difference is that, like previously, people still needed, you know, clothes to go to work. They still needed to wear makeup, et cetera. They still had things to buy. A lot of those end uses are, you know, kind of gone in the short term right now.
Like, you can put that blazer on sale for 70% off, but if I'm not going to the office, I'm not buying a blazer. Doesn't matter how cheap you make it. So this time around, retailers are trying to make a profit in a different way. They're going to sell less stuff, but hold the line on prices. And that strategy kind of builds on itself, because going into this fall and winter, retail executives said they expected demand to be low, so they bought less inventory. Sonia Lipinski is a managing director at Alex Partners.
There was almost a risk of not having enough product for the holiday season, but it also allowed them to at least not have to be so promotional.
Because customers will pay more for something when it's in short supply. Now, the thing about the strategy retailers used during the last recession, it kind of created a monster with a long tail. Shoppers got used to the discounts and still expect them more than a decade later.
We've trained the consumer over the years to wait for the deal and wait for the sale. And this is actually giving some retailers an opportunity to shift that behavior.
In other words, maybe this moment will be a sort of reset and create a new expectation that the price you see is the price. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Five words for your listening pleasure tomorrow morning. David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. That's it. A lot of people are making decisions right now about what they can and can't afford in this pandemic economy. Decisions both practical and personal, whether or not to have a child being one of them. There is some research out from the Brookings Institution showing we might wind up with a lot fewer kids next year, 300,000 to 500,000 fewer. Which, given that we are 9 months into this thing and biology being what it is, that might start becoming evident pretty soon. Melissa Carney is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a co-author of the report. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how you got to these numbers of fewer births.
Sure. So what we did was we looked back at what happened to birth rates after the Great Recession. There's a link of about a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate leads to about a 1% reduction in the birth rate. And then we also looked back at what happened during the Spanish flu. And what's really interesting to think about is back then, people didn't even have access to modern contraceptive technology, right. Nor did the Spanish flu lead to a recession. So that was really just a public health crisis, but it led to a sizable reduction in births. And so based on what we see in the data from those two previous periods, we predict that there's going to be something like an 8 to 10% drop in births on account of this current pandemic.
Which is, in raw terms, as I said in the introduction, 300,000 to 500,000-ish fewer births next year. What does that mean? Not in the next year, right? Because, yes, having kids are expensive and it's an economic thing. But when those children who aren't going to be around would have turned 18, it becomes a labor force issue.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the big questions is how many of these missing births are going to be delayed versus never happen? And the longer this pandemic goes on and the more permanent the income losses are, then the more likely it is that these births are just never going to happen. And so you combine this large bust with the steadily declining rates of births we have in the country before the pandemic, mm-hmm. and you start to worry about what's going to happen with a shrinking workforce and fewer workers to not only contribute to the country's productivity, but to support our social insurance programs.
Right. It's the whole fewer workers already paying into Social Security thing, right?
That's right.
Right. Is there, I mean, look, we need people in this economy to be the labor force. So one could imagine a policymaker looking at this and saying, this is going to be an issue. If they call you on the phone and say, Professor Carney, what ought we do about this? What ought they do about this?
If this was just going to be a one-year reduction and then births rebounded, I would be less worried about the demographic implications for the country. But given that fertility rates have already been steadily declining, you know, this points to the need for what are called pronatalist policies, things that make it easier for couples to have and support children, things like childcare provision or subsidies, things like paid leave, induce some people to have more kids.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. This is an intensely personal decision that you and economists writ large, right, try to put sort of a quantifiable lens on. That's a tough circle to square sometimes.
Yes. Yes. When you talk to non-social scientists, they're often like, wait, falling in love, having a baby, isn't right. that about some other stuff? But, you know, having kids is one of the largest economic decisions people make in their lifetime. And when people see their incomes increase or decrease in unanticipated ways, they have more or fewer kids in response.
Right.
So there is lots of evidence to support this idea that this is in part an economic decision.
Melissa Carney is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland, also at Brookings as well. Professor Carney, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
So, you know, if you are canning your own food, at least you're like, I've got that covered.
Mason jars, anyone? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 148 today, about 0.5%, 30,069. The NASDAQ gained 55 points, 0.4%, 12,520. The S&P 500 down 7 points, almost 0.2%. 36 and 91 there. Kristen was telling us about what a song is worth. Dylan-wise, it has been a minor key year for musicians in this COVID economy with live shows, the bread and butter for most of them, not happening. But streaming is up more than 5%, more than $5.7 billion in sales by the middle of this year. That's according to the Recording Industry Association of America. So some of the big players in streaming media, Spotify up today nearly 7%, Apple up 1.2%, Netflix up 3.5% on the day. Yield on the 10-year T-note down 0.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I know it's been a while since it dominated the business and economic headlines, but Brexit, it turns out, is still a thing. Britain is out of the European Union officially and finally at the end of December. All that's left to figure out, 4+ years after the vote and something like 3 weeks until the deadline, are the terms between Britain and its biggest trading partner, which is why Prime Minister Boris Johnson's going to Brussels this week for some last-minute negotiations. Also at issue, as the UK gets to make its own deals from now on, is the state of economic play with the United States. There are the big-picture problems, market access and tariff structure, for instance, and some more industry-specific causes. Chlorine-washed chicken, hormone-treated beef, also fur. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Protests like this led to a ban on fur farming in the UK 20 years ago, but fur imports are allowed. Claire Bass of Humane Society International says it's time to end that anomaly.
Fur farming was banned in the UK because it's inherently inhumane. But since then, we've had this double standard. We've been importing the same product that we banned in our own backyard.
This footage of mink, apparently mistreated, clawing at their cages, was filmed, she says, at a fur farm in the EU. An example of the animal cruelty that pervades the industry, she says. Brexit will end the automatic obligation to allow fur into Britain.
Leaving the European Union and the single market gives us the opportunity to end that double standard and to stop funding the fur trade.
The British Fur Trade Association, or BFTA, denies that animal cruelty pervades its industry. It insists that all of the $270 million worth of fur imported into the UK every year comes from farms or from trappers that are subject to strict animal welfare regulation. Nevertheless, the British government is mulling a total ban on all fur sales. Fur has already disappeared from many fashion shows. High-profile brands like Gucci and Versace eschew it. But, says Giles Roker of the BFTA, the product was featured on the catwalk at London Fashion Week this year. And he says the government ban would be an unwarranted attack on a successful industry.
The UK is the seventh largest importer of natural fur in the world. It is a buoyant, successful, growing market. Sales have increased by around 180% in the last decade or so.
And banning natural fur, he says, would not only hit the fur trade. The US ambassador to the UK has suggested that since a British ban would block fur imports from the US, that could jeopardise any free trade deal with America.
I think the UK government needs to reflect very carefully whether it wishes to move forward with this, potentially damaging a future UK-US trade agreement worth billions every year.
Anti-fur trade campaigners pour scorn on the claim. Mike Moser was once a fur trade champion. He was head of the BFTA, but he quit last year after a change of heart.
Because I could no longer defend the unacceptable welfare problems that are systemic to factory fur farms and trapping of wild animals.
Moser does not believe that a fur ban in the UK would scupper a free trade deal with America. For one thing, the US exports barely $3 million worth of fur a year to Britain.
Such a minuscule amount. I really, really cannot see that that's going to be a feature in any trade agreement.
But the fur trade has its supporters. Victoria Hewson of the free market think tank, the IEA, says a sales ban would be a bad idea, just as the UK launches itself as a global trading nation.
I think it really could cause damage to our desire to be seen as a supporter of free trade.
She says many potential trade partners, and not just the US, might worry
that future sales of goods could be subject to this quite arbitrary ban in the future.
The argument goes on and is likely to intensify and widen as the UK gains independence from the European Union and gets to decide its own trade policy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
...2020 has been in some ways defined by shortages. Testing supplies and PPE early on in this thing. Now hospital beds and healthcare workers. Those obviously are the serious ones. On the less serious side, toilet paper, yeast, also bicycles there's a shortage of, and mason jars. And as it turns out, this isn't the first time our collective interest in the humble mason jar has been piqued. Jen Dahl wrote about it for Medium's Marker. Jen, welcome to the program.
Nice to talk to you.
I will quote you back to yourself as the first question in this interview. You say in this piece, there may be no better barometer of the state of our economy than the mason jar. Discuss.
Well, when I started digging into this story, I talked to several historians, and, you know, not only are there mason jars that have been with us since the late 1800s, mm-hmm. there are also mason jar historians. And the thing that they all told me was, this isn't anything new. This happens every decade, every 12 years. You know, it's like the runs on mason jars tend to occur when there is some kind of economic instability, recessions, in wartime, basically anytime that people start to freak out about where they're going to get their food, if they're going to have enough food, what is happening in the world. I want to also just clarify that really the lids are the things that sell out more so, because you can't reuse them, or you're not really supposed to reuse them.
Yeah.
So
as I was saying before we got going, we got a zillion mason jars in my house. I don't think we have more than a lid, maybe two anyway.
Yeah.
Is the thinking that canning and putting up preserves and whatever one does with a mason jar, we're like nesting and that makes us feel better?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it is that. It's also, truthfully, like, if you don't know where your food is going to come from, it's also sort of a more psychological need to find control wherever you can. So, you know, if you are canning your own food, at least you're like, I've got that covered. And, you know, it makes us, like, we're baking bread, we're making our own kombucha, like, we're doing all of these things, and canning kind of goes along with that.
No, it's totally of a piece. Let's say I get motivated upon hearing this interview, and I decide to start canning. Can I go on Amazon and get myself a 12-pack, and everything's going to be fine?
You may be able to do that now. You know, during the summer and fall, it was very hard to find these jars, so and lids as well. There was, like, some really high price gouging going on. Also, there's a problem of people who are not Ball are trying to put off their jars as Ball products, and
I'm sorry,
not.
We're in counterfeit mason jar territory now. Is that where we are?
Yes.
Wow,
it's that crazy.
Wow.
That said, there are tons of distributors, and you can probably find them online at this point because the canning season for the year is pretty much over. That also said, there are people who can all year round, so who knows? Good luck.
Right. No, totally. And look, if you're a dedicated canner, you're going to can. There are, though, this is the wrong word, but there are off-peak uses for mason jars, right? And by off-peak, I mean, even when we're not in a recession and deeply stressed, people are using mason jars for all kinds of things nowadays.
Totally. And it makes sense, because if you're a manufacturer of, you know, canning jars, during times when jars are not selling out, Ball and other manufacturers have been marketing these jars for all kinds of other uses, like, you know, putting your beans in, putting your, like, using as decorative items, mason jar candles, mason jar wedding glasses. You had to have a mason jar at your farm-to-table wedding. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Jen Dahl, writing in Medium's Marker about mason jars. Jen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, one more entry in the IPO parade as 2020 draws to a close. Petco, now in the hands of private equity, filed its IPO paperwork last week. The company says the pet care industry is in the $100 billion a year range, includes 72 million households, which I believe, but it is not why I am doing this item. The company's new ticker symbol? I like it a lot. It's a pretty good one. Woof. W-O-O-F. Pretty good, right? All right, we're going, but here's your Monday moment of economic context. Comes to us courtesy of Heather Long at the Washington Post, also every now and then a Friday on this program. She cites a study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia out a little bit ago, showing more than a million households where people had lost jobs due to the pandemic are now $5,400 on average behind on their rent and utilities. Think about that for a sec. Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Rial Hahnhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios are the daily production team around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.